Welcome to episode 46 of Speak Feasty for October 8th, 2017. I'm Eleanor.
I'm Megan.
And we have a new official host, Aurelia, from Germany. Do you like to tell us a bit about yourself?
First of all, I'm super excited to now be an official host of this amazing podcast.
Yay!
I've been on before, but for those of you who probably don't remember, I am a Gryffindor. I am a Horned Serpent at Ilvermorny. And for MuggleNet, I am working on the content team, so I'm making sure that the website looks all fancy-pantsy. Yeah, and now I'm also an host for Speak Feasty.
What do you do in your Muggle time?
In my Muggle time, which is very rare. No, as already said, I live in Germany. I work as a marketing manager for a software company.
And oh, cool.
If I still have time for that, I play basketball and, you know, sometimes I sleep.
That's the dream, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. I'm also slightly sick, which is probably why I sound a bit off, but I'm getting
it. I think you sound great.
Okay, that's cool.
Thanks for joining our lovely little podcast team.
Yeah, thank you.
Family, really.
Yeah. Eleanor, how long has it been since you've been on?
I was here since the beginning.
How long?
Jesus, I don't know though. It's been a while. It's been a few months because yes, it's been very, very, very sad. So all I've done is like listen to the podcast and been like, oh, and I keep like going to say something and doing that classic podcast thing where you're like, ah, and then you're like, oh no, I'm not actually talking to these people. That's cool. So, but yeah,
I'm glad that I actually get to talk to you today. This is very exciting.
It is very exciting.
We already said that we managed to cover Australia time, European time, and America time at the same time.
Yeah, I feel like we're on like different thirds of the world, right? Because you're like,
yes.
Okay, so it's 11:30 p.m. here. What time is it over there?
Oh, wow.
It's 2:28 p.m.
2:28 a.m.
That's so cool.
Podcasting over coffee. And you're going to bed soon. That's so weird.
Yep.
Time zones are crazy.
I know. Yes. I love it though. It's like, I was like, I think we have covered most, like, I think we've covered pretty much like the thirds of the world with this one, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. It's pretty spread out.
I remember.
Technology is amazing.
I remember when I flew from Auckland, New Zealand to San Francisco, America, and then you just basically start the day over again because of time zones.
Yeah.
Because you're like, New Zealand is you're like all the way at the beginning of the time, basically, and you fly all the way back. So I left like Sunday afternoon and I arrived Sunday morning. I was like, so I do that day all over again?
My dad did the opposite and skipped an entire birthday once. I think he came from LA to New Zealand and skipped the day. Anyway.
Yeah.
That's sad that he had to skip his birthday.
Tis, but he survived it.
And now a message from our sponsors.
Hey you! Yes you! The magical cats and dolls waving your wands like bean shooters in a caper. Looking to be on the up and up about Newt Scamander, famous zoologist and world traveler? No need for gossip at the juice joint, just tune your ears to Speak Beastie. And now for as little as one dragon dollar a month, you can make Speak Beastie the Neasles Meow. Support the show at patreon.com and suddenly you're the big cheese, the real McCoy, with exclusive access to swell sneak peeks, bloopers, and behind-the-scenes features. But wait, there's more! more, sponsors can also beat their gums at the joint with access to the Speak Beastie Common Room on Facebook. Now you're really on the clean sweep, flyboy. Get a wiggle on to patreon.com/speakbeastie to learn more about becoming a sponsor today. It's the Billy Wigs Knees and How.
And now for the Phoenix Register. I think I got the inflections, but I don't think I should try to do impressions in general. Cool. So there is basically no news at all. But we have some exciting podcast stuff going on right now. So if you're going to New York Comic Con this year, you should keep an eye out for Lizzie and Elena and our third new host, who we won't reveal yet. We'll let her introduce herself when she gets to be on an episode. But if you see them, be sure to say hi and talk about nerdy beast stuff with them. They would be excited to see any of our listeners that happen to be there. Another cool thing is that in November, I think it's, is it the 16th? That's the 1 year anniversary of the Fantastic Beasts movie coming out.
It should be the 18th.
Well, for us, it was the 17th, just to really throw spanner in the works there.
So on November 18th, which is the 1 year anniversary of Fantastic Beasts' worldwide release date, we are going to be doing something cool and fun and exciting. We haven't quite revealed what that is yet, but keep your eye out for that too, because we're going to do something fun and you should be a part of it. Literally, there's no, like, there's nothing about the film happening right now. Yeah. I looked.
They're still filming, so that's all it is.
If you're not already, you should follow Dan Fogler on Instagram because he's been posting some fun stuff. Not necessarily from, like, the set, but he has a couple of, like, Funkos that of like, Jacob and Newt that he's been playing around with. So that's kind of entertaining. Not really news, but fun little tidbit to tide us over until we get some more stuff from the next film.
We've been reduced to Dan Fogler's Instagram posts of his Funkos.
They are amazing. I mean, just the fact that he has Funkos of his own character.
I know.
That in itself is amazing enough.
I think there are worse things to be reduced to, personally.
True.
Yeah. So, for the outpost, we got a couple of good comments from our friends in the Speak Beastie Common Room. Mike says, on the Vila question, I don't see how they could be classified as beasts in that they can produce children with humans. They're also defined as female humanoid magical beings, so there may be no male equivalent. Among themselves, they probably reproduce by parthenogenesis?
Yeah.
Not too unusual for some creatures. Still, I'd vote for humanoid magical being, not beast. Thumbs up. So, the Vila question was, would you consider them beasts or not, and why? Eleanor, what is that word, parthenogenesis?
Parthenogenesis.
What does that mean? I just figured you knew because you knew how to say it.
Well, it's just like, I mean, okay, this is what I assumed it was, and then I double-checked because it's been a while since I've done biology. But essentially, it's just, I don't think this guy is right because it's asexual reproduction. So the offspring just develops from basically the egg and it doesn't actually need a male. And I was like, yeah, I thought that's what he meant. And I was like, I don't think so though, because like Fleur has two parents. I mean, otherwise her mother could just, you know, wouldn't have had to even bother with another guy. I'm not completely sure. Unless it's optional. I don't know.
Isn't she only part Vila though? Like,
she's a quarter Vila. Sorry, quarter Vila. Yeah.
So maybe if you get a man in there, then that like dilutes the Vilaness and you're only part Vila? I don't know.
Yeah, but it means that you don't have to be asexual. You don't have to be asexual. Like, but you can be. It's, anyway, possibly, basically. Yeah, I mean, I guess, I feel like no, though. I feel like otherwise, why would you even bother breeding with a human anyway? Like, if you're, I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, this is bizarre. but yeah, no, I reckon like they're definitely not beasts though. They're beings. So,
yeah.
Oh God, I forget how that's classified.
But again, you could say the same for the mer people. I mean,
yeah,
they're like, also humanoid. So,
like giants wouldn't really be beasts because they can reproduce with humans.
Yeah,
but
don't get me started on that.
Well, we're going through a very similar debate.
Let's not think too hard about it.
What they did in the 14th century when Burdock Muldoon, the chief of the Wizards Council, was attempting to define beings. So, you know, this is a typical debate that has been roaring in the magical community for over, what, 7 centuries now. So, you know, it's cool that we are mixed up about it. But essentially, I mean, in terms of what you're talking about with merpeople were excluded from the beings classification, and so the centaurs got angry on the merpeople's behalf and said that they weren't going to be beings either then. But essentially they're viler beings, if you're going to put it that way.
I personally think Jo wrote this because she was like, I don't know how to classify this, so I'm going to make a huge, like, debate on it so that I don't have to classify stuff. And then again, you know, like, mere people and generally, like, as opposed to, like, beasts or beings in the water, why would they care what people on the land call them? I mean,
yeah. Well,
they're not going to interact much, so...
It's a typical human thing to try to put stuff in categories when, like, there's all this gray area involved and you really just don't need the categories.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But how do you regulate? Because some of these, like, creatures need to be regulated and others do not. So for a being, especially with centaurs and stuff like that, they don't want to be, like, governed by anyone else, whereas obviously you're going to need that when it comes to the dragon population. So, you know, like, you do need these categories. Yeah. But, yeah, I checked Harry Potter Wikia. A being is officially any creature that has sufficient intelligence to understand the laws of the magical community and to bear part of the responsibility in shaping those laws. So Vila well and truly fit into that.
Yeah.
Fun fact, Minister for Magic Grogan Stump in 1811. Just that's where the definition comes from, if you feel like knowing that.
Well, yay. Good job, Stump.
Remember that for the next trivia.
Yeah. So we got another good comment from the common room from Colleen. She was listening to episode 42. And the question was, why did they use the death potion? She says, because casting Avada Kedavra and murdering someone fractures your soul. Humans feel better when some sort of contraption, like an electric chair or a death potion, kills the criminal.
But I have thought of this. Doesn't Harry brew this, like, liquor of death? I'm not sure what it was called. For the Felix Felicius potion in Half-Blood Prince.
Oh, yeah.
Wouldn't that be
drawn
easier?
Drawn of Living Death.
Yeah, Drawn of Living Death. Yeah. Wouldn't that be easier just, like, give them a drop of that and then they would just die? I mean, why does whole big room swimming pool sized with potions in it?
Yeah.
I mean, I get the reasoning behind the Avada Kedavra and that definitely makes sense, but there's definitely more than one potion to kill someone.
Yeah, and it is like very theatrical, like with those childhood memories that they're showing, and like, I don't know, it seems like they're attempting to relax the person before this happens, but like, why?
Yeah, it's kind of like, hey, we're killing you, but at least you're gonna have fun, which
it's gonna be really nice.
Okay, I mean, I would assume there would be a way to, like, give someone a sleeping potion and then they'd just die in their sleep, which would
probably be
the least.
She's just speaking to those, but that whole section there is just, it's like a, I guess, a reference to what was happening in the Muggle world, because they'd just sort of gotten a hold of electricity and started making electric chairs. Like, I think it's a bit earlier than the 1920s, but in the 19.
Aren't they still doing that?
Oh, I don't want to know.
I mean, I know they were like,
they don't use, like, there's like maybe one or two states that still have that, I think, but most of the time, like, we still have the death penalty in some states, but it's usually lethal injection.
Yeah, which would be more like the draw of the living death, I suppose, if we want to draw parallels.
There's a lot of, like, there's a lot of, like, controversy over how humane it actually is, and, like, I don't know, there's, like, all this weird stuff. I don't know. I could get into it, but I won't.
it's this kind of a massive podcast. Subject.
Like, yeah,
how to kill people. Oh, my God. But I think, I mean, it is interesting what you're saying about how Avada Kedavra will fracture your soul versus, you know, having contraption won't. I don't know. I think it's one of those things of whether you feel the responsibility of killing the person and, although, I mean, I guess the way J.K. Rowling would put it.
But that wouldn't make sense. I mean, the soul is not like something, I mean, it's obviously not physical. So why should it only be attached to spell casting and not potion making? So I could see your point that it matters if it is if you feel responsible for the death.
Well, because otherwise, I mean,
although then you know, like Harry feels responsible for Sirius' death, and that's a whole different thing.
No, but I think you'd have to have some sort of action in, like,
yeah.
That- I don't know. That is an interesting question in itself. That is interesting. But I think, like, in one of those things, it's kind of – it always irritated me with this kind of stuff, which is – I suppose it's playing to the sort of biblical aspect of, like, only humans have souls and therefore, you know, killing a human is the only way to, like, fracture your own soul. But, you know, like, you're always killing rodents or – pests or whatever, and that doesn't do anything to your soul, and I was always like, that's a bit unfair, but that's just me.
Yeah, I mean, Newt is a vegetarian for a reason. After all,
anyway, but yeah, I think that's interesting. I think that's what it's speaking to, is that, you know, that that biblical sort of hurt, like, yeah, like, I think that's what that's harkening back to, but I'm not the expert in any way, shape or form.
Yeah. So we can conclude that there would be different potions that could also work. And it's probably just a political statement, Joe.
Probably.
I mean, it was a very obvious picture, so.
Right.
Also, it just looks cool.
There was a chair. Yeah. I think you're right.
I mean, there were a lot of issues with that scene. Actually, I think I might have said this in a previous episode, but I wished that the point of that pool was to, like, the state to take all of the person's memories, and then that goes into, like, a catalogue for the state, because I think that just sounds so much more, like, evil and, like, interesting than just a random pool that's going to eventually kill you. But anyway...
That could be another political statement to, you know,
maybe
data security and how we act on the internet. But not to take this too far.
Well, hey, she does say never trust anything.
It might come back into play later.
But J.K. Rowling does say don't trust anything if you can't see where it keeps its brain. And I'm like, that's a really interesting thing to have written, like, just the internet's taking off.
Yeah, that is true. I never thought of that.
It could, I mean, knowing her, it could very well come back into play later. Like, it could have a bigger purpose in the series. I don't know. We'll see.
Mm.
Well, I'm still not, I'm not 100% sure we are actually going to go back to America. Because I imagine that just the first movie is going to be, like, in America, and then the rest is going to play somewhere else. I was kind of hoping, like, way back when we were like, there was going to be movies about Fantastic Beasts, that it's going to be, like, a world tour, and then we're going to see, like, Africa, going to see, like, South America.
Oh, so was
I. See, like, Australia, New Zealand, or, like, some
like China,
Asian,
something, yeah, India.
Something like go somewhere else. And now, like, the second movie is in France, which is like, okay, it's not Britain, but it's still Europe. So
you already you got your shot in Goblet of Fire, France. Why do you get this one too? It's fine. I'm not
And then, you know, Grindelwald, we're not sure yet, but he's probably either German or like Swiss or Austrian. So that's Europe as well. So, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
But I still think we're not going to head back to America.
I don't know. I think it's pretty likely. I mean, just purely because why would she put out all that stuff about Ilvermorny and nothing comes of it? I feel like she put all the, she published all of that for a reason, you know?
Yeah.
Did she though? I mean, most of the people, like, not maniac fans like us, they don't even know. They don't even know their schools are, like, outside of the Harry Potter canon. Like, if I tell people, like, oh, yeah, you can, like, go on Pottermore and start your Hogwarts house and your Ilvermorny house, people will be like, what was the second thing you just said? Or, like, the American school. Uh-huh, who cares? Yes.
But I think that's like
a thing, really.
From a purely commercial perspective, what you really want is a whole bunch of Americans being like, I want to go to Ilvermorny and I want to buy the stuff from my house because I watched this movie about it. And I feel like it's too good a marketing opportunity to pass up and for them to just stay in Europe. But, you know, I'm a cynic.
Which, you know, back to the world tour, go everywhere, give that to every place in the world.
I think it's kind of like, I don't know, I can draw a parallel to like when the Potter movies were coming out, like the fans who actually read the books had all this more like background and information than the fans who just watched the movies. So it's kind of the same way with this, like it's not a book, but it's, you know, a certain amount of like research and background knowledge that the people who watch the movie just don't really have.
Mm.
Yeah, but even, I mean, the first movie didn't really do anything for Ilvermorny. It was mentioned, like, once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and I still want to know. I still don't really understand what my Ilvermorny house means. I still don't really get it. I'm like, the warrior, okay? Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like Gryffindor to me.
I know that, in the Alohomora podcast, they had this whole conversation if, like, Gryffindor and Ilvermorny houses, like, tie along. And we had this spreadsheet where everyone of the listeners could just, like, put in which Hogwarts house they had and which Ilvermorny house they had. And there's literally no parallel.
I know, which is so bizarre. No. I find that absolutely
none.
Yeah.
It's because, like, people be like, Horned Serpent is a Slytherin house, but I'm a Gryffindor and a Horned Serpent, so obviously that doesn't go along.
Yeah. Huh.
And just because, you know, Slytherin snake and Horned Serpent snake, come on, people.
Wait, what are you again, Megan? Because you're, yes. Because I'm Aurelia. Oh, Thunderbird and, wait, you're Ravenclaw, no? Yes.
Gryffindor.
Gryffindor, by that. Ah, wait, you're both Gryffindor and Horned Serpent. No, yes. No, you're Thunderbird. It's fine. I'm cool. I just heard what you said. What are you talking about?
This recording at night thing is confusing for you.
It's fine. I'm cool, man. That's interesting. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because, yeah, I'm Slytherin and Wampus. Just completely different. But, yeah.
Yeah, but there's seriously, there is no ties between those two.
It's
just a completely different, I don't know, measure system in a way.
Yeah. Crazy.
Crazy stuff.
Say goodbye to all the owls.
Oh.
Bye. See you next time.
Bye, Hedwig.
Bye.
So, I think it's time for main discussion. And yay. I thought, because I loved it when you guys covered, like, all the American myths and places and whatnot the year before the first movie came out, because as a non-American who had no idea about any of that, that was super interesting. And so I thought we could just as well use the year that we have to cover a bit more about France, because France is more than just Paris, although people tend to forget that. and so I picked a mythical place that I want to talk to you about, and it's called Mont-Saint-Michel. And I hope I didn't completely butcher that, because I had French in school, but it's like ages ago. So I was hoping that, because I have a map here in the dock, but I'm hoping that people can either pull out Google Maps and just Google it, or, you know, pull out a map of France, or maybe we can just post it with the podcast episode. So anyways, Mont-Saint-Michel is in the Normandy, which is in the northwest of France. It's at the coast to the Atlantic Ocean, just north of Rennes. And if you would draw a line from Paris to the west, all the way to the Atlantic Ocean, that's basically where Mont-Saint-Michel is. Just to give you a bit of an image for those of you who don't have a map in front of you. And again, I can only hope that you get a photo to Mont-Saint-Michel, because the photo really sells the place. Because even for me, who like grew up with castles all around, this one is just bloody magical. It is just, you just look at it and you can see like all the mystery coming like off it. But for the sake of this podcast, I will try to describe this place a bit. Mont-Saint-Michel, as the name already says, at least if you speak French, Mont is the French word for mountain. And it's like a small mountainous island located in the Atlantic Ocean, close to the coast. And it is separated from the mainland by a narrow strip of sand, which in former times was submerged beneath the tides for several hours each day. So there were hours in the day when no one could reach this island, whereas, you know, when there was low tide, you could just walk over to it on this strip of sand. Nowadays, of course, there's a small street built up on the sand strip, so Mont-Saint-Michel is reachable at all hours, which is obviously because of the massive tourism the place gets. In fact, it's like the second most visited place in France with over 3 million people a year, which is a lot. Yeah.
Is the first Paris?
Yeah, definitely Paris. And I thought we'd just like go take a quick dip into the history of the place before we talk about more of the magical stuff.
It's a mini time turner.
Yeah, mini time turner. So, way back, the original site was founded by an Irish hermit who gathered a following from the local community. Mont-Saint-Michel
so
was
it's
used
Celtic.
In the... Yes.
Ah, oh, that makes
way,
sense.
Way, way,
okay.
Way back.
Well, no, it's because it's part of the Celtic Sea. So you have Scotland, you have Ireland, you have Wales. You used to have Cornwall, though not so much now. And you also have that part of Normandy and Brittany that they're all part of the Celtic Sea. So they all speak Celtic languages.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that Irish hermit came across. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's that's the whole like history between France and Britain. You know, there was a time when French conquered Britain, and that's why there's a lot of like British French word in the English language, and obviously the other way around, because that's just how it is with neighboring countries. So, Mont-Saint-Michel was used in the 6th and 7th century as an Armorican stronghold for Gallo-Roman culture and power until it was ransacked by the Franks, thus ending the trans-channel culture that had stood since the departure of the Romans in 460 AD. Which is just cool to see that there was a whole like trans culture, you know, between the channel. Because I actually didn't know that there was like the whole probably like trade and stuff between those two.
Yeah.
But that was all before any construction was on the island, because the first construction of the monastic establishment is in the 8th century. And by that time, the island was called Mont-Tremble. And according to legend, the archangel Michael appeared in 708 AD to Aubert of Orange, the bishop of Afrange, and instructed him to build a church on the rocky island. So, the first bit of myth and religion here. And then, after the first church was built there, a community of Benedictine monks settled on the rock in 966. And soon thereafter, a pre-Romanesque church and the first monastery walls were built. So that's basically the first beginnings of there actually being a castle on that island. We jump ahead a bit to the 13th century to the King of France, the current king being Philip Augustus. He donated funds to the monastic institution at the Mount, thereby enabling the beginning of its Gothic period construction. Le Merveille, the beautiful 13th century Gothic abbey towering 500 feet above the sea level, is crowned by a statue of Saint Michael in the act of killing the devil in the form of a dragon.
No.
That alone. I mean, that alone. The devil in form of a dragon. What would Newt say to this?
So rude.
How rude. Another fact is Mont-Saint-Michel was never taken in battle. It almost occurred in 1425 when only 125 French knights valiantly held off more than 8,000 English troops.
Uh-huh.
Like, 125 against 8,000.
I don't know why, but that just reminds me of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Have you guys seen it?
Yeah.
I've seen it in German, which is why I never get any references, but yes.
Okay.
I have to rewatch it in English.
At the end, there's like two French knights in this castle and like a whole bunch of troops like running towards them, and they held them off by like flinging livestock at them. And then it turns out it was never a real thing in the first place, but I don't know. That picture just popped into my head.
Yeah, and I mean, if you have a like walls all around an island that is only reachable, you know,
by one tiny islet, it's a pretty classic military strategy. There, it's been used many times. I think is Agincourt was like that, and they managed to force a big force into a tiny area. And the Battle of Salamis was like that, where they had a big force, the Persians against the Greeks, and the Persians were, if you faced them in an open sea, you'd be dead, but they got them to force themselves through a tiny inlet. And so, you know, it's a very effective strategy. It's beautiful. Excellent. Yeah. All right.
Very recently in 1966, for celebration of the 1000th anniversary of the monastery, the French government permitted the restoration of the monastic life on the Mount. And a group of monks and nuns began living in parts of the abbey and now give tours to pilgrims and tourists. So it's just very recent that there's been people living there again. So, you know, just to keep it in mind for Fantastic Beasts timeline, where it's like, what are we now, 1927?
So there wouldn't be anyone much there. I wonder who would be there.
Exactly. And the last bit of history, in 1979, the UNESCO included Mont-Saint-Michel on its list of World Heritage Sites. And I think that's very well deserved. And I have one more fun tidbit for us geeks out there. Mont-Saint-Michel was the inspiration of the design of Minas Tirith in the film The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, where we have a similar, you know, people trying to storm Minas Tirith and they are holding it back. A similar image.
Yeah, except they weren't smart and they didn't have just like one tiny islet. They had like a massive plain. So, you know, didn't do that very well there. Anyway, but that is what Mont-Saint-Michel looks like. It does look like the white towers of Minas Tirith.
Yes, definitely. So, imagining us, that could be in Fantastic Beasts 2, because as I just said, it was basically not populated by our timeline for the second movie, at least. So who could live there? And I mean, I could see either Grindelwald having that as a stronghold, or it either being the place for the French ministry, if it's not Paris. Mm. Or, you know, it could be like an Aura stronghold because it's the border area to Britain. Mm. Like, it could be so many places. I definitely think it's a visiting place, though. It's not, obviously, it's not Muggle populated, so.
Yeah, definitely.
And I'll be very certain that wizards would live there.
I'm so confused about how borders work in the, like, wizarding world. Like, is it the same as us, or, I don't know.
I'm so confused how distances work in the wizarding world.
Yeah.
Like, people who, like, live in Scotland have to go to London to take a train to Scotland to go to school.
I feel like they would just go to school, though. Because, I mean, that time Harry got the night bus, right? Like, you don't have to take... You don't have to take the Hogwarts Express. So I feel like if you did live in Hogsmeade, they wouldn't ask you to go to London to go up to Hogwarts.
let's hope they did that. I mean, but yeah, I mean, I could also see people just be like, hey, I live in Hogsmeade, but I wanted to go on the train because I can see all my friends.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, distances don't really make sense. If you can apparate to places or have the night bus or, you know, stuff like that. So.
But you can only apparate within a certain distance, but we don't know exactly what that distance is.
Yeah, I mean, apparently if you can apparate from Scotland to London, you can apparate from London to France.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean.
And, like, all across Europe.
That definitely should not be an issue.
And South
I mean,
East
I think
Asia.
It's like bigger water bodies, like you could not operate over the Atlantic Ocean, like stuff like that.
But maybe you just need like an island in the middle and you just operate to that and then you operate to the next bit. Like,
so you could know, like
maybe
operate to Iceland, then to Greenland and then to Canada.
Mm. Or maybe you could just like... be on your broomstick and just sort of apparate, but like with it, and so you just sort of dot along. I don't know, man. I'm just throwing very ridiculous ideas out there.
And Deathly Hallows, when Voldemort can fly, Harry's like, "Oh, soon he'll be close enough to apparate," because he's like flying across an ocean.
Yeah.
I don't know, like,
but that is typical,
isn't
it?
He didn't think of that.
You're right, because witches and stuff, that was like a classic thing of like water and witches had problems and you could always tell a witch because obviously she didn't drown, she floated and stuff like that. So maybe you're right, it's water bodies, that's the thing.
But then again, J.K. Rowling said she specifically chose Vernon to go onto the island in the first book to like hold off the flock of letters, and then, you know, Hagrid obviously has no trouble whatsoever to reach that island, even
but
in
he
the
does
storm.
Do it. He does do it like with a boat, like the Muggle way. He doesn't apparate.
No, he flies to get there, and then he uses the boat that the Dursleys use.
That's right. Damn it, you're right.
Which is why I always wonder.
He
like,
doesn't
how
apparate.
How did the Dursleys get back on land? Because obviously the boat's not there anymore.
I just like
that is a good question. Maybe they swam.
Maybe they like can swim.
This has gone really off the rails. Anyway. We should have a main discussion topic someday about whether or not the Dursleys can swim. Because I want to explore that topic personally.
Yes. So back to Marcel Michel. What are you guys thinking? Like, could you see the French ministry being there, or do you think it's definitely in Paris? I mean, I'm sure you could hide it somewhere in Paris as well, so.
I like the idea of it being Grindelwald's place because it's, like, close to the British Isles.
Yeah.
So it would be easy for him to kind of have an influence in both places if that was, like, kind of where he was hiding out.
Maybe yeah, like, it would definitely be easy to get over to Britain from there.
Could have been a jail.
It used to be a jail in Muggle times.
Mm.
Maybe it's Azkaban.
No. I don't think. Azkaban's in the North really Sea. Close to France.
But we don't know where Nurmengard is. But Nurmengard, I mean, obviously by the name, it's not going to be in France.
Yeah, it's supposed to be basically in Germany.
But it could be the French prison. Could have.
It could.
And then maybe Grindelwald, like, takes it over and, like, converts all the crazy prison inmates to his cause. I don't know.
I like that idea.
That just happened.
I mean, I'm also not really sure. Does, like, do you see Grindelwald as someone who has, like, people he trusts, like, you know, like the inner circle of the Death Eaters? Or is he more like a person that definitely operates all alone?
I will be very, very, very irritated if he's like Voldemort. I will be very irritated. I feel like he's the kind of person who's very, very charismatic, and people do what he wants them to, not out of fear, but because they genuinely believe in his cause. I think that would make it really interesting. I don't think they're going to do that.
Like, from what we know, Grindelwald is more, I don't know, not want to say intelligent, but he goes about his whole cause more clever than Voldemort does. He's like, Voldemort, like, is a lot like led by feelings and emotions, whereas Grindelwald seems to be more based on his facts, maybe.
Yeah, Grindelwald definitely has, like,
but he has a cause, like, that's not his own immortality.
Yeah, he has a cause. He has ideas that he really wants to, like, perpetuate, whereas Voldemort sometimes is just kind of evil because he's evil. Like, he just wants to hurt people.
Yeah, and he's just, like, he wants to rage.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, Grindelwald definitely had most of Europe following him or under his control, whereas, you know, Voldemort had Britain, and even that not completely.
Well, and the fact that Grindelwald was defeated in 1945, like, she's definitely drawing a parallel between him and, like, other sort of dictators of that time.
You can say Hitler. I'm not going to be affronted.
Hey, we could have been talking about Mussolini.
No, I was. Right. There were a couple. But
there were a couple.
There were a couple Stalin. Of guys around then that were. Yeah. But they had, like, these. He was kind of evil. But they all had these, like, very specific ideals that they were trying to have, like, become more of a norm in society. It wasn't so much just, like, I want to live forever and I hate everybody.
Yeah.
But it was also at that period of time, you had so many ideas.
Which is why I'm wondering how Grindelwald is organized. Because we know Hitler had his 4 or 5 people that were very close and helped him with his plans. I mean, as clever as Grindelwald may be, I don't see him, like, in control of everything just himself. I assume he had to have at least, like, 2 or 3 people who would be, like,
Especially because he kind of tried to get Dumbledore to be his, like, right hand.
Yeah.
Dude, and it didn't work out, but that doesn't mean that he didn't find somebody else.
I don't think he even was thinking of Dumbledore as, like, a follower. I think he was very much like, the two of them will go and convert the world, like, together. You know, you didn't really get a sense that he was actually going to try and, you know, make Dumbledore, like, his second. It was like, they would both do this. I think that it's just a matter of him making sure that people are converted enough to his cause that he doesn't have to worry about, you know, if they're going to, you know, turn their back on him. It doesn't matter about that. What matters is it matters about the cause. And, like, as long as they're true to that, it doesn't matter. And then he'll find good people in that who are very good at logistics and admin or whatever else that you need to do in magical world, and then, you know, and then you're fine.
You got resources. Your...
Yeah, exactly. But he was a legilimens.
Yeah, I mean,
so...
Yeah, that's true. Another parallel to Hitler, though, they Hitler had this castle in Bavaria.
Yeah,
that he and his closest people would go and have their meetings up on this, like, it was like up on the mountain.
And fun fact, in The Sound of Music, when they escape over the mountains, they're escaping right towards that place, which is why that movie is not accurate in any way, shape, or form.
But I love that movie.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if we, go along with, parallels between Grindelwald and, Hitler or any other dictator, that would work to have, his castle place for his closest.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would still think, the French ministry would probably be in Versailles.
Yeah.
Because the French are pompous and they would do that. I mean.
Also, you're not going to have your ministry on a secret entrance.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true too.
Sorry.
If I were the French ministry, I would want to be at Versailles. It's very pretty there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is. And I mean, the doctor comes to visit. Sorry. Different fandom. So we kind of all agree that this is probably where Grindelwald is during Fantastic Beasts 2.
Yeah,
he must be.
Or we could at least imagine. I really hope, though, that they include this in the movie.
I do too.
Just because
I do too
of the visuals.
Really cool. Mm. Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, it would really be a missed opportunity. They did.
Yeah.
I'm also going to have to add this to my list of places to visit, so.
Yeah, me too. And I'm a lot closer, so I'm probably just going to be do a short, 2 or 3 day tour to go there.
Yep, I want to go there too. Just thought, throw my hat in the ring.
Just go there together on one Patreon, day. Pay for us to go have a Speak Beastie family trip to Boston. It's the new pledge that you can do. It's only 50 bucks a month.
So, do you want to dive on into the Newt case?
All right.
I think it is time for the Newt case.
Get excited. The Newt case. Mm-hmm. I'm going kind of crazy here by choosing a dragon, even though it's not a dragon that's officially in the dragon, index in Fantastic Beasts. But I was like, no, it's a dragon. I like dragons. It's a French dragon. So we're going to do a dragon because I love dragons. And I think the last time I did a dragon.
I always get excited when you do the Newt case, Eleanor.
Yes.
Why?
Me too.
It's very worrying.
And plus, dragons are cool, so.
Exactly. So, yeah, I'm just sort of I kind of wonder exactly what type of dragon it is. I mean, yeah, I'm just, because there are so many of them. I'm just like.
Doesn't it also say in the book that those the 8 that they show, they are the major species, and there's a lot of subspecies or something?
Well, that's the thing, because the thing is
correctly,
yeah, in the in Fantastic Beasts book, there is no French dragon. The closest you're going to get is probably there's the Welsh green that we know about. Otherwise, I guess it should be between Romania, Norway, Sweden, or Hungary. That's where the other closest dragons are coming from.
So Wales would be the closest place to France.
I think Wales, yeah. I think Wales probably would be. So this is quite possibly just a Welsh green, and maybe this is actually not that interesting at all. But hey, I'm going to tell you about it. So basically, this is actually thanks to one of my lovely friends who I was like, I want a French fantastic beast. And she was like, well, this is the beast from my hometown. So anyway, so it's the city of Metz, which is in northeastern France. So near the border to Germany. And they celebrate the feast of the defeat of the, I think it's Glauli or Glauli, I don't know, dragon.
Yeah, it would. from how I would say you pronounce it, it's Crowy.
Crowy.
But, so yeah. If it's like, if you have double L's, it's you don't pronounce the L's.
I know, but it doesn't have an I there. And normally that's the thing that really tells you. Anyway, I was, Crowy.
I don't know.
anyway, but essentially, so on the 23rd of November and on Christmas Eve, that's when everyone celebrates the Feast of the Defeat of this marvelous dragon, which is very, very sad. And like many things in France and I guess in Europe, you sort of have this blend of Christianity and like folklore together. So what happened with this one is that the first bishop of Metz was apparently sent by St. Peter during the first century to vanquish the local dragon and other snake-like dragons, as you do. So, but yeah, and it's like one of these things where like I'm reading it and it's just, you know, it's there's such a sense of mythology to this, because it's saying that the snake's breath and or the dragon's breath had so poisoned the area that the inhabitants were effectively trapped. And that was one of the things that you get in Norse mythology, where like Jormungand, the serpent, apparently his breath or its breath was like that, where, you know, it was so potent, it would come up as a mist and you couldn't get through it, that kind of thing. So anyway, it's kind of cool. So I feel like there's probably a bit of sort of crazy Nordic stuff coming into this, as well as the sort of local folklore and everything else. But anyway, so he vanquished the snake breath, dragon breath that had poisoned the inhabitants, and because, thankfully, he converted everyone to Christianity, because that's how you get rid of dragons, guys. You convert to Christianity. And yes. So, and because they agreed to do so in return for ridding them of the dragon, because that is how all religious conversions should happen. And so anyway, and so apparently what happens is like Clement went to the place where the dragons were, he made the sign of the cross, and you know, they were just immediately tamed. And I feel that's the thing. I'm like, did you have to be a bishop to do that? Because I feel like other people would have probably been freaked out by this dragon and would have tried everything. So you must have to be a priest or a bishop, or whatever, to do it. Anyway, so, and then this is the sad part.
So people, if you travel to France, take your local bishop and a cross.
Yeah, just in case.
Just in case.
Maybe some holy water. But yeah, so basically the bishop, he led Glaoui, the dragon, to the edge of the sea, which I assume is the river there, and ordered him to disappear into a place where there were no men or beasts. So sad. I don't know what happens to the dragon after that. Anyway, but that wasn't actually enough, apparently, for the local king. I think his name was like Aureus. Anyway, because, you know, you tame a dragon, it's not enough, not going to do it. So then what happened was his daughter died. And then this bishop, because a dragon wasn't enough, he had to bring the daughter back to life. And then the king converted to Christianity. So, you know, you just got to have your own little sort of Jesus resurrection, then you'll be fine. And then, yeah, so then after that, the Glaoui, I guess, quickly became the symbol of the town of Metz, and it can be seen in lots of demonstrations in the city, and, you know, since the 10th century. And in the Middle Ages, they had, like, a huge, I guess, effigy of the Glaoui, and it was carried during processions in the town. And usually they would make it out of hay, and it would be 12 feet high. So it's kind of relatively enormous. But, yeah, and also I guess it's one of these things where
If they made it out of hay, would they then burn it?
See, I don't know. Maybe they did. I feel like you would.
That's usually how you do it.
I think you would.
You make, like, huge stuffed hay things and then you just burn them.
Yeah, they are, like, celebrating the defeat of this thing. So setting it on fire seems
apt. Like, overkill. Like, dang. I did not like this dragon.
You know.
They were really pissed off.
I just, oh man. I just love this stuff because it's just got so much of that, the religion and the folklore and the sort of probably recent Viking invasion and stuff all playing into each other. It's amazing. But yeah, it's also one of those things, I guess, where it's a bit like Jack Frost for us, although Jack Frost isn't really like that anymore, but the dragon is, you know, told to children, and that the dragon will punish you if you, you know, do things wrong. And obviously it's a sort of affiliated with Christmas Eve and stuff. So I guess it's a similar type Santa Claus-y type thing, just not with the good part, just the bad part. And apparently on Christmas Eve, you can see the dragon in the main square, in Metz, if you want to see it. And apparently that's a thing that still happens, and there's lots of food there, and you can go and you can check out Glowy and, you know, enjoy his, immolation. Anyway, so that's the new case.
Awesome. I feel bad for the dragon.
I know, so do I. I always read things like this and I'm like, was the dragon that bad? Probably not. He's probably just hanging out. He probably was just like...
See, I just looked up where the city is.
Mm.
And, you know, when I'm going to do my trip to Mont-Saint-Michel...
You can go via Metz.
Like, I could do Metz, then Paris, and then Mont-Saint-Michel.
Yeah. See, that's what I do. I'm also a travel guide. Ah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Travel.
Yes.
Presented by Speak BC. I hate, though, that, like, dragons are always killed in the myth.
I know. I love them so much.
Every myth that you have. Like, even from, like, the small place that I'm from in Germany, there is an ancient volcano.
Mm.
Like, it's not active. It's not been active for, like, centuries. But obviously, like, way back when it was active, people would have, like, the stories and the myths. And obviously, it's like it was a dragon that lived up on the hill. Or, you know, fire spitting and everything.
Yeah.
And then there's like the story, like there came a knight because the village would always like give the, I think, most beautiful daughter to the dragon to take basically to make it happy. And then there was this knight that like killed the dragon and married the daughter, like the kind of like standard myth that you get.
Yeah.
Yeah. Poor dragons.
Poor dragons.
Wikipedia says that the dragon would have devastated the city before being chased by Saint Clement of Metz. It doesn't give a lot of detail. Like, what does that mean? Devastated the city? I guess just ruined everything?
I don't know. I just found the poison thing, which meant that they were, like, entrapped. I'm assuming it was eating the population. I feel like that's a dragon-y thing to do. It's very, like,
probably.
What is it? Incarnation of the devil in some way and, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is why, you know, Saint Michael is stabbing the devil in form of a dragon.
Mm.
Yeah.
It all ties back.
This Wikipedia page also says this legend represented the destruction of pagan religions by Christianity.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah, that too. I can see that. Huh.
Poor dragons.
Yeah. Poor dragons.
I could definitely see that being like a Welsh creed that probably traveled over to France.
Although I don't know if there's a dragon that like spits poison.
I mean, that could also just be a myth.
Mm.
Like, it could just have spitting fire and people are exaggerating. I mean.
Yeah, true.
It's being dramatic.
You never know.
Spitting poison is kind of.
I mean, it doesn't say what it looks like, but, you know, we know the Welsh green is green and it has two spiked horns.
And then we don't know if the Welsh green is really called Welsh green because they all live in Wales or if it's just where they found the most of them.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, they seem to be living in Wales.
But they would like Wales because of the mountains, you know. So it has to find, like, mountainy places. So maybe, like, this Welsh green, because they are very territorial from that thing with the, you know, beach.
There's mountains in France.
Yeah, exactly. So it probably was, like, got thrown off its, like, home mountain because they're so territorial, and it went flying around a bit and it settled in this place in France and ate people, and there you go.
Yeah. That's how it is. And then it found the wrong ring. Oh, no, that was the wrong pendant again. Because it really, like we were talking about this village and everything, and it was kind of like I saw the whole visuals of smell killing the people in the lake. But,
So yeah. Much fandom crossover today.
Yeah.
Yes. And I'm sorry for it.
Oh, never be sorry.
You're not.
I'm trying to, do you think I could convince my family to go to Metz for Christmas Eve this year? Because I want to see a dragon.
Yes, I do. Oh, after my friend said that, I was, suddenly, before that, she was, come visit me. And I was, sure, I'll come visit you. It's a long way. Whatever. And now I'm, right. I have extra motivation.
Well, if you do come, because for Christmas time, I'm usually back to Stuttgart area. Let me know. We can meet up.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
And go dragon hunting together.
Yes! That sounds so cool.
Speak Beastie dragon hunting field trip in France.
Yes.
This Christmas.
Yeah. People who want to join, come join us.
Yeah, let us know in
we'll
the
be meeting
room.
In France. Okay, for the podcast question of this episode, we would like to hear your ideas what Monster Michelle could be in Fantastic Beasts 2. Like, any ideas that you have.
And do you think it'll be in it? But also, what will it be? Sorry.
Yeah. So, people, what will Monster Michelle be, and do you think we will be seeing it in Fantastic Beasts 2? So, we'd love to hear from you, so drop us an owl on any of our social media outlets or email us at speakbeastie@gmail.com. And don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.
You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at speakbeastie, on Facebook at facebook.com/speakbeastie, on Tumblr at speakbeastiepodcast.tumblr.com, or you can support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/speakbeastie. And you can check out our website at speakbeastie.com. I'm Megan.
I'm Eleanor.
And I'm Aurelia. Case closed. I can hear the music.
That was a good one.
That was fun.